the Musikant Gottes, you know, this term, the musician of God, perhaps a bit over...
They do it too much for you. Now, we could spend the rest of our time just talking about different editions and the revisions, particularly for the Fourth Symphony this evening. But you have brought us a couple of recordings, Roddy, including the original 1874 version, Roger Norrington's
recording. Can I prelude that before we hear it and introduce this? Because this, in a sense, is like watching Miss Marple meeting Poirot, because it's the most wonderful detective story which has gone on. And it's partly to do with the fact that Bruckner's lack of success, relative lack of success, until very late in his life, and then even so, it was not very, very successful, led to the fact that there were no real definitive editions of any of his music that were in print. Imagine, when Brahms gets it, he does sketches, he writes a final version, he revises the final version, and then burns the sketches. So what people perform is what's in print coming out of Simrock. This is not the case with Bruckner. For instance, in the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions, and he revised it substantially once and then substantially internally again after that. And from this, of course, it's led in the 20th century, which is really the time he came to people's attention, for people to try and arrive at a definitive edition. And you wouldn't think that was very difficult. Off goes a scholar, probably with a grant, goes into a library in somewhere, picks up all the sketches, works out the authenticity of the sketches, puts all the notes in the right place, puts the accelerandos in the right place, and the written, yeah. You would think so. The trouble is, while these were being constructed, another ideology was going on at the same time, which became much more clear in the 30s, and that is the rise of Nazism. In particular, the search for an Aryan symphonist, as opposed to someone corrupted in the city like Brahms and supported by Jewish critics like Hanslick and so on. So it got tied up with a kind of ideology, which is where, of course, people start to say this great sort of church piece and so on, even though the Nazis are not so keen on that. So when they appointed an editor of a new Bruckner Ausgabe to correct edition, they appointed a member of the party called Robert Haas. And when he came to look at something like the Eighth Symphony, into that he incorporated a little bit of himself. His solution to what Bruckner intended was based on what he thought Bruckner ought to be. This was all then undone when Haas lost his job for obvious reasons in 1945 and replaced by a man called Leopold Novak, who took a slightly different view of it. But even then, British critics like Derek Cook would say, oh, well, we don't need to bother with any of the earlier versions. They're simply sketches. The problem is that Bruckner put the sketches into the Imperial Library in his will and said something like, soon they will understand, i.e., the revisions which had gone into print weren't really what he intended. Nothing could be more complicated. So with the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions. The first one he wrote is in 1874. And until comparatively recent, you couldn't get a copy of this. But now you can get a recording of it. Because Roger Norrington, with the Stuttgart Orchestra, recorded in Stuttgart, did a performance of the 1874 version. And this is how the finale opens of that version.
Thank you.
Maybe it's worth almost immediately hearing the same movement conducted by Furtwängler in an edition which will be played tonight from the late 1880s. And for those of you who don't know this symphony very well, it begins for the first two or three seconds the same. Bum, 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 bum. Then the next thing you hear in the Norrington is a quotation from the beginning of the first movement. Bum, bum, ba, bum. Then after a while, you hear when it reaches the climax, the tune bum, bum, dum, like that, that you hear, which is where the example has just finished. In the Furtwängler version, i.e. in the late 1880s version, what you're going to hear is the repeat of the opening of the first movement doesn't appear at all. He cut that out. He replaced it by this very grand theme. And when Furtwängler conducts it, you will notice that he begins very much as though he was in church, and then he gets rather excited. And he adds a rather exciting and thrilling accelerando up to the accelerando doesn't appear in the score. This is Furtwängler's invention.
That's a very different sound, isn't it? That's the Vienna Philharmonic and Wilhelm Furtwängler in October 1951. Probably quite a different sound to today's Vienna Philharmonic as well, who are coming to the Proms to play Bruckner's Eighth Symphony with Lorin Maazel this coming Friday. Roderick, we heard Norrington going back to the original score as close as he's prepared to for the finale of the Fourth Symphony. We heard Furtwängler in 1951, a very different approach and much more of that sort of grandiose late 19th, early 20th century tradition of Bruckner performance. And we know all the cliches. We know about these people saying that his symphonies are cathedrals of sound. We tend to look through stained glass at Bruckner when we think about his symphonies. Are our ideas of his music changing?
Well, I hope so. And certainly Norrington is doing his best to change our view of what that should be, and other performers nowadays, because he needs to be rescued from a particular kind of tradition of playing it. I mean, to some extent, Wagner was thought of as that, and if you trace how Wagner was performed from when we know he conducted, for instance, the Prelude to Meistersinger, he did it, and it took him 8 minutes. It took Klemperer 11 and a half minutes. For a piece which is that short, it had got slower and grander. And unfortunately, in a sense, Bruckner suffers from a reception. I'd have to make sure that we make the point about the difference between the Norrington and between the Furtwängler, and that is it's a different piece. It may be very grand, but the notes are completely different. So it gives us a very good idea of what he thought his symphonies might be by the revision. Or was it his idea, or the people who corrected his ideas and persuaded him? And was it the idea of orchestras who did a whole lot of things without being told what to do? Can you believe it? So in a sense, a whole lot of things, untangling the web. And I think what I'd like people to be able to do is to re-look at Bruckner as a symphonist who stands in the line of Schumann, Mendelssohn, and particularly of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I think in some ways we need, as it were, to rescue him from being the embodiment of a sort of messianic vision. Not exactly a religious vision, but an ideology of a symphony that could last as long as the Third Reich. And it's hard to untangle the whole ideology to make him a real man living in the 1860s and 70s, hearing Wagner for the first time, deeply embedded in polyphony, in the music of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert. One of the most striking things about the Fourth Symphony you're going to hear tonight is after he's begun this rather, you know, the sense of the knights advancing or whatever the meaning of the opening is, you break for a moment and you're absolutely in a moment of Schubert. It comes from the Austrian countryside near where he lived. It has nothing to do with the vision of heaven. In some ways, it's an aspect which, if you perform it too sepulchrally, too much with the sense of, you know, this is a man writing these great spaces, you would miss that almost witty point he makes when doing these. And that's the thing I really like about the Norrington recording. Having stripped it away, whatever you think of the edition, it's sort of like Sidney Smith, if you remember, the reverend who made witty remarks, seeing two women shouting at each other from the top of two buildings. And he said, those two women will never agree because they're arguing from different premises.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much indeed, Roderick Swanston and Klaus Sonnleitner. That was a discussion recorded earlier this afternoon across the way at the Royal College of Music, and the producer was Juan Carlos Jaramillo. And there are just a few proms pluses left before the last night of the proms. Look online or in the proms guide for details, and don't miss Klaus Sonnleitner's performance on the Royal Albert Hall organ to begin Friday's prom. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the proms here in London's Royal Albert Hall. It's hard to believe that after 2 months and 69 proms, we've almost reached the last night. By the way, I misidentified the encore that Christian Ila Hadlin gave us after the Beethoven in the first part. It was actually William Byrd. I ought to be able to tell the difference between my French and English keyboard composers. Byrd's Galliard from my Lady Neville's book. This evening, our visitors from Norway, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra and chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, are conjuring up the atmosphere of 19th century Vienna in 1801 with Beethoven, which we heard before the interval, and now with a major symphony from almost the other end of the century, Anton Bruckner's Fourth, the one he himself decided to call his Romantic Symphony. You could call any of his symphonies romantic in one sense, so perhaps what he meant was the concept of courtly love popular in medieval high society, given the simple descriptive programme Bruckner provided for early performances, a vision of dawn over a medieval city in the first movement, a procession of knights venturing forth, then the magic of nature envelops them, and there's a hunt in the third movement scherzo. But it's hard to tell, given Bruckner's insecurities about his symphonies, whether this was a concept he cared about or whether it might have been forced on him by those who thought his music needed help to reach an audience. For our conductor, though, Vasily Petrenko, there's a bigger picture.
Bruckner, he really asks questions. What are we in the face of nature, in the face of God? What are we? What are the nature of humans? Of course, he wrote this program about morning and then horn calls and the beautiful landscapes and the valleys, etc., etc. But I must remember, he was always a very faithful person. He spent most of the time serving church, serving God, as an organ player, as a symphonist, writing pieces like Te Deum, which is massive belief. And I think he also been raising for himself, first of all, those questions. If the nature is so beautiful, and if the God created that, why then we humans, we need to suffer? Why then we have so much drama and pain in our lives? Why can't we live in harmony with nature? And all that, especially in the finale, with all the segments, it's like a puzzle, this finale, and to bring it all together and to create this movement towards the final appearance of initial theme through all the fight for it. This is quite a big task for conductor and for the orchestra, but that's what he was writing about. I think he was writing about this eternal journey of human towards the most beautiful world and towards the most beautiful society, towards the fairest society, towards the fairest world, through the God, through the nature, or through the social things.
Tonight's conductor, Vasily Petrenko. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic's leader is Elise Botnes, and here is Petrenko to conduct them in Anton Bruckner's Romantic Symphony No. 4, which we'll be hearing in the Novak edition of Bruckner's revised 1880 score.
Thank you. Thank you.
After so much doubt, rewriting and revision, there's no doubting the blazing certainty at the end of Anton Bruckner's fourth symphony, the one he himself called his romantic symphony, performed for us here at the BBC Proms by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko. And as we reached that final conclusion, the smile of almost ecstasy spreading across his face was a vision as well. Back he comes. Applause from the orchestra, the strings tapping their bows as well. And that roar was for principal horn Inga Besserudhagen. And immediately after she got to her feet, she made sure the rest of her section stood as well. Section by section, the brass standing, now the winds. And the strings. Vasily Petrenko shaking hands with the Oslo Philharmonic's leader, Eliza Bodnas. Well, I hope that's whetted your appetite for Bruckner. It's one of the most eagerly anticipated concerts in this last week of the Proms. Is Friday's visit from the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, will be conducted by Lorin Marzell in Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Meanwhile, for the Oslo Philharmonic's next concert, Petrenko takes them to Dublin tomorrow, opening the National Concert Hall there's international season. Back he comes. The orchestra stands. Petrenko, pretty much the tallest man on stage, touches his heart and offers his appreciation to the crowd in front of him. He has a really nice, easygoing relationship with the orchestra, as we heard in rehearsal. All in English, by the way, the rehearsals, in case you were wondering. When they were sorting out some rehearsal issues in the Szymanowski concerto for yesterday's Prom, he described the sound as porridge, and then very good English porridge. Here he comes again, and the bows tapping still on the music stands. And looking at their faces, the grins, the smiles, the way they're looking at each other on stage, I think they've enjoyed this evening as much as the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall has. Well, it's the BBC Symphony Orchestra's turn tomorrow with Finnish conductor Osmo Vanska, and after Tchaikovsky's first symphony last night from our Norwegian visitors, the BBC Symphony Orchestra's playing his last, the Pathétique, as well as Goretzky's Symphony of Sorrowful Songs and the world premiere of Anthony Payne's orchestration of Vaughan Williams's four last songs. So it's a trio of farewells, I suppose, when you think about it. But right now, let's bid a fond farewell to the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, who've been great company over the last two evenings. And we'll wish them a safe journey across the Irish Sea for tomorrow's concert in Dublin's fair city. Stamping, greeting Vasily Petrenko as he returns to the platform and puts his arm around the shoulder of the Oslo Philharmonic's leader. Glorious Bruckner to end their visit to the BBC Proms this season. And waiting for us back in Broadcasting House, here's John Shea.
Thank you very much to Andrew McGregor presenting tonight's First Prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can listen to it again anytime you like over the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website. And if you missed our other Scandinavian visitors this week, Camerata Nordica, who gave last Saturday's Proms matinee at Cadogan Hall, well, you can hear their concert again tomorrow afternoon at 2, music for string orchestra by Britton, Tippett and Walton. Now, look ahead to next weekend here on Radio 3.
Pioneering artist Laurie Anderson traces the roots of possibly one of the most daring and popular of all contemporary art forms.
A retrospective of the work of Marina Abramović was presented in 2010 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. In one part of the show, called The Artist is Present, she sat motionless for 3 months, while visitors could take a seat in front of her.
Living and Present. Laurie Anderson on Performance Art is the Sunday feature, Sunday night at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall in just under 50 minutes from now for the second of tonight's proms, a late-night concert by the BBC Singers featuring music by Benjamin Britten and George Lloyd. That's at 10 o'clock tonight. Before that, another chance to hear one of our features from earlier in the year as Matthew Sweet tells the story of Dr. Alex Comfort, author of The Joy of Sex. That's in a few minutes at 9:15. So before that, a return to the Slavic theme of last night's first prom by the Oslo Philharmonic. Piano music here by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Margaret Fingerhut. Scherzino, and before it a piece called A Little Song, two pieces by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Margaret Fingerhut. This is BBC Radio 3, it's 9:15, and time now for tonight's feature. Last year marked four decades since the publication of The Joy of Sex. Its author, Dr. Alex Comfort, became synonymous with his best-selling book, but that image has blotted out an extraordinary career, as Matthew Sweet discovers now in a programme called Stop Calling Me Dr. Sex.
Alex Comfort, when he lived in California, he used to frequent this swingers community called Sandstone. It was a clothing optional community. Gay Talese, in this account, Thy Neighbor's Wife, describes this community and Alex Comfort's presence there. And Talese describes him wandering through this orgiastic scene, like a butterfly collector wandering through the fields, and he was smoking a cigar, looking approvingly at this adult playpen in this sex community. And apparently he was put the cigar down after a while and join in enthusiastically.
What's your position on the joy of sex? For most people, it's a big, thick, illustrated embodiment of the permissive society of the 1970s, a gourmet guide to lovemaking from an era when gourmet meant prawn cocktail and Black Forest gatto. We're given to snigger at it, but we shouldn't, partly because its roots are as far away from the suburban key party and the swingers' hot tub as you could possibly imagine. Atrocity, injustice, barbarism, annihilation, the horror and violence of World War. These were the forces that shaped The Joy of Sex and its author, Dr. Alex Comfort. He was that guy tapping ash from his cigar on the margins of a Californian orgy. But he was also one of the most underestimated public intellectuals of the British 20th century, a man whose incredible range of enthusiasms, whose passion for ideas, has been lost in the shadow of that best-selling sex manual. In 1976, Alex Comfort complained, "I don't want to be known as Dr. Sex." And to the end of his life, he struggled to push the rest of his career and his achievements back into the light.
It was largely a matter of accident. And don't forget, sex is not my main activity. My main activity is aging. If you see those books up there, all the books I've written, all the books about sex, very few of them about aging, and that's because there have been hundreds and hundreds of translations all over the world of this one book on sex. But it is a bit of an albatross around my neck.
But where did all this begin? In suburban North London, with something really quite horrible that happened long before the sexual revolution and the bombing of Hamburg in the spring of 1935. This is the back garden where Alex Comfort played when he was a boy in the 1920s and 30s. It's also where he suffered an accident that might have stopped his extraordinary career from happening at all. With me is Alex Comfort's son, Nicholas. Nicholas, what kind of childhood did your father have here?
Well, it was a very happy one. I think it was fairly intense, though. The whole of the sitting room was lined with books, and he was encouraged to read them.
And a lot of these books on the shelves were about the First World War.
The First World War was a big part of my family's life because my grandfather had been seconded from County Hall to go up to Yorkshire and supervise the production of uniforms for the troops, and specifically the conversion of the uniforms that came back bloodied from the trenches into new cloth. And I think that sowed the seeds of pacifism in my grandfather, and I think this was probably a fairly powerful influence in my father following the same road.
The carnage of the trenches loomed large in the imagination of the teenage Alex Comfort. It haunted his reading, too. Professor David Goodway is a leading scholar of Comfort's work.
When I first approached him, I asked him, when and how did you first become a pacifist? And he said, when I was a schoolboy, by reading First World War reminiscences.
But the horrors of recent history weren't his only teenage interest. He liked Meccano and mollusks and gunpowder.
It was the weekend of George V's Silver Jubilee, and my grandmother had grounded him from going to the cinema. And he and a school friend stayed home and started making fireworks in the greenhouse that used to be on the back of the house up there. And their first effort produced a large crater in the lawn. And my grandmother then sent his friend home. And Dad, being a persevering type, kept going. And he was working on getting everything into the tube when there was a stray spark, and the whole lot went up, including the greenhouse. The explosion basically destroyed his left hand, and he was obviously in a lot of pain, and while they were waiting for the ambulance, he actually rang his friend to say, please don't do this experiment, because the same thing might happen to you. And fortunately, they got him into hospital and found an extremely accomplished surgeon who managed to reconstruct enough of his left hand that he still had a workable thumb.
And what happened in the aftermath?
My grandfather took him on a tramp steamer to Buenos Aires. He was fascinated by the life on board ship. And when he came back, he wrote a book called The Silver River, which was basically a more or less non-fictional account of his travels.
And he's still a schoolboy?
He's still a schoolboy. He was just 16 now. The book was called Diary of a Schoolboy in the South Atlantic.
I do not believe the fable that men read travel books to escape from reality. They read to escape into it. From a crazy wonderland of armaments, cant, political speeches at once insincere and illiterate, propaganda and social injustice, which the lunacy of humanity has constructed over a period of years.
does seem extraordinary that a boy who's undergone this traumatic experience, you know, loses these digits, his answer to this is become a writer.
It spurred him on. The people who felt the trauma were the rest of the family. One of his aunts left him £50 because he would never be able to earn his living. My grandmother first and then my grandfather realised that, tragic though it was, he was probably going to achieve even more than he would have done otherwise.
So Comfort emerged from that suburban garden as a writer and as a pacifist. Growing up in the bloody wake of the Great War, Comfort was hardly unusual in his opposition to armed conflict. But by 1940, his views were being tested by fire, the enemy's and Britain's.
At the moment we can see two bright flashes, three flashes from the other side of the channel, and three great puffs of smoke, another fourth. And any moment now the shells will be arriving over this side.
As the Nazis devoured the continent and Britain steeled itself for invasion, many of Comfort's fellow pacifists renounced their beliefs and took up the gun. And Comfort?
He sticks with it and becomes even more committed and goes on and doesn't relent and is a pacifist throughout his life.
When the war actually began, I think he simply saw more futility, more carnage and the like. And although he'd never have done anything to frustrate the war effort, he felt it very important to take a stand and register as a conscientious objector, even though, because of his disability, there was no chance of his being called up to fight. He was not in any way an uncourageous man. He went out with his tin hat on to treat casualties of V1 raids and the tail end of the Blitz. So he had observed all this at close hand. He just felt it was wrong, and that despite what many people were saying about the enormity of the enemy we were fighting, war was something one simply should not be associated with.
In 1941, Comfort was establishing himself as a poet. He was still only 21, but he was already making an impact on literary London, partly because of his pacifism. That's what got him into a skirmish with one of the big guns of that world, George Orwell.
Comfort also claims that Orwell's out of touch with young writers.
To thrash out what happened next, I brought together Comfort expert David Goodway and DJ Taylor, biographer of George Orwell, around a pub table in South London.
Which is wrong, yeah. There's a number of them were fighting in the middle.
In 1941, Comfort published his first novel, No Such Liberty, which was overtly pacifist and made provocative comparisons between Nazi Germany and wartime Britain. In October of that year, Orwell reviewed the novel in a Delphi magazine. So I asked David Taylor, how did he react to Alex Comfort and his arguments?
He described him as an absolutely pure pacifist of the turn-the-other-cheek variety.
Insofar as it hampers the British war effort, British pacifism is on the side of the Nazis and German pacifism, if it exists, is on the side of Britain and the USSR. Since pacifists have more freedom of action in countries where traces of democracy survive, pacifism can act more effectively against democracy than for it. Objectively, the pacifist is pro-Nazi.
Did Comfort turn the other cheek?
Oh, no, he hit Mac hard. So he comes back following year in Partisan Review. I see that Mr. Orwell is intellectual hunting again. He's very aggressive.
Perhaps he will grant that Hitler's greatest and irretrievable victory over here was when he persuaded the English people that the only way to lick fascism was to imitate it.
Inevitably, Britain would start to commit atrocities in the war against Germany.
We began feverishly jamming into our national life all the minor pieces of fascist practice which did not include socialist methods, sitting on the press because this is total war, making our soldiers jab blood bladders while loudspeakers howl propaganda at them because the German army consisted of efficient yahoos.
He asks our Orwell what the artist can most usefully do. He thinks it's by temporarily supporting the status quo rather than by wandering around in Epping Forest with a pocket full of hand grenades.
And so there's a kind of groundswell of anti-Orwell sentiment welling up in Partisan Review, and he replies with this enormous kind of 4 or 5 page screed defending himself against absolutely everything.
The idea that you can somehow remain aloof from and superior to the struggle while living on food which British sailors have to risk their lives to bring you is a bourgeois illusion bred of money and security.
The altercation between Comfort and Orwell doesn't stay on the pages of Partisan Review. It moves into Tribune, doesn't it? And it goes metric. Yeah. It goes into poetry.
A year later, Comfort bursts into Tribune with 15 satiric stanzas. Comfort has now moved on to become an anarchist as well as a pacifist, and he goes on a thoroughgoing assault against all the war criminals in England as he sees them. Against Churchill, he says...
You've heard his nibs decanting year by year, the dim productions of his bulldog brain, while homes and factories sit still to hear the same old drivel dished up once again. You've heard the church's cartwheels to explain why bonds are Christian when the English drop them, the union bosses scrapping over gain, while no one's the temerity to stop them, or have the racketeers who try to bleed 'em flogged, like the Indians for demanding freedom.
Wells' riposte is quite, it's obviously hostile to Comfort, but it is quite nuanced because he doesn't indulge in Churchill worship. And there is a rather extraordinary line where he says that as for Churchill, he'll gladly shoot him when the war is done or even before if there was somebody there to replace him. But then there's this killer couplet, I think at the end of the penultimate stanza, where having referred to the Comfort line about accepting the status quo, he says,
which will sound better in the days to come? Blood, toil and sweat, or kiss the Nazi's bum?
Which I think really brings the exchange to a conclusion.
Whatever you think about who won this literary argument, it does suggest that Comfort was an extraordinarily confident young man at this point.
Amazingly so. It's good for him. He develops his own theory of anarchism, his version of anarcho-pacifism.
And he's also engaged in some kind of dialogue with Orwell, who wrote to him in quite emollient terms after this exchange. They exchanged correspondence. They met once in 1945 in a pub in South London. And Orwell wrote for his magazine, New Road.
So they're closer then intellectually too than this exchange would suggest.
I think so, yeah. Orwell's own position had been very similar to Comfort just before the war.
And there is, in a rather oblique way, an interesting connection between Orwell's great masterpiece, 1984, and the career Comfort subsequently pursued. There's that marvellous paragraph in the novel where Winston and Julia are alone together, and she turns to him and says, you know, when you've made love to somebody, you don't give a damn. You don't care about whatever political systems may surround you. You know, you are free. You can then begin to live some kind of life that is truly yours. And I think that phrase could be said to underpin Comfort's subsequent theorising, the idea that the political structures that are most appropriate to humanity can only work after they've reconfigured their personal and emotional lives, and this is the way to begin it. So in an odd way, I think that novel is quite closely related to a lot of Comfort's later thinking.
So there is some common ground here between them intellectually. They both might have what you could call a kind of anarchist attitude to sex.
I think so. What Julia said is pure Comfort.
In 1942, the war took a turn that strengthened Comfort's opposition and made it clearer to him than ever that Nazi barbarism was nurturing the same instincts in the Allies. British Bomber Command directed its firepower against German civilians. It launched the 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne in 1942. In the following years, Allied bombs burnt the oxygen out of Hamburg, Berlin, and Dresden. Those campaigns remain controversial today, but in the heat of war, few on the British side offered any challenge to them. Few except Alex